You are listening to the fifth season of Rio Grande's For the Love of Jewelers podcast, a celebration of jewelers, the jewelry community, and the art of jewelry making. In this new season, we are excited to announce that there will be a rotating cast of Rio Grande Jewelry Tech team members hosting the show. We will share our love and knowledge of jewelry making, along with interviews featuring industry leaders, educators, and fellow jewelers in the community.
Good morning and welcome to Tech Team Tuesday, live at 11. My name is Shane Hendren, and today, my special guest is none other than the glorious Greg Bergard. Greg?
Yes.
Give us a little bit of background information on you. How did you come to Rio Grande? Okay, let me be more specific. Give me a little tidbit of what you did before you got to Rio Grande.
Okay. Right before I came here, I had a phenomenal job. I was the new product development director for a large manufacturer. And basically, my job, obviously, was to develop new product, but anything between the concept or an idea mm-hmm. to production molds, hand it over to production.
Right.
Everything in between there, I did that. And we produced anywhere from 12 to 30 new styles per week.
Holy cow, that's
a lot. I had about 15 people working in my department. We made all the production molds. We did all the models. I used a lot of outside 2D and 3D artists for wax carving that was really pre-3D printing. Mm-hmm. So they were all carved by hand. I had 2D designers, and I would give them direction about lines that we wanted to create. For example, if we wanted to make a line of girls' sports charms.
Right.
And so we would have them designed. I would choose sometimes we'd modify the designs on paper, and then I would hand out those to various 3D wax carvers, basically. Then we would get those in. We would make molds on them. And then we would make wax injections, build our own trees, send them over to casting. We didn't do our own casting. Send them in for casting, get them back, clip them off, clean them up, sprue them, trademark stamp them, check finger sizes, make sure stones fit.
Right.
And we did that as also part of our verification. And we gave them item numbers and everything, and we did three samples of everything. One went to the president for pricing, one went to marketing for photos, and another one went to salespeople for samples.
So how many years did you do that?
I did that for about 20 years.
Wow, 20 years before you even got to Rio Grande.
Yeah, it was a great job because, like I said, I got to fly to big customers like Avon and QVC and make special products just for them. So it was great.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you also did all of their pewter work in your own business on the side.
I had we did also part of what I did in product development was make, you probably remember in the 90s, all those dragons and wizards and stuff with all the crystals on them. Well, we did that, but those models were made in bronze.
Okay.
And so we did that in my department. That was part of the 15 people that worked there. So half of our production was doing that stuff in pewter. The other half was doing it in silver and gold. Mm-hmm. And I actually started another business with a friend of mine, and we had a shop next door, and everything I made there, we sold through my day job because they had a great sales network.
But you weren't done there. You also, because what I admire the most is your glasswork.
Yeah.
And you have a number of patents.
Yeah.
For things that you've designed and everything. So while you were doing these other two jobs, these other two full-time jobs, you had another business that was exclusively, explain that business.
Yeah. So I went to, I was going to an art fair, and because a friend of mine was a painter. Actually, he was one of the 2D designers. His name is Dick Wimberly. He lives in Santa Fe.
Shout out to Dick Wimberly.
Yeah. And so he was one of our designers, and I was just going to go visit him and see what he was doing. I walked past this one, it was the school building over at mm-hmm. the fairgrounds, and they were having a glass show. And I thought, I'm in the jewelry business. I'm going to go in there and see what this is all about. And I walked in and I saw torches and flames and big colors, you know, in what we do, and in the jewelry world, most of the colors that we see are like this big.
Right.
They're small stones. But with the glass, it was all the people wearing these big glass, beautiful red and bright colors. And I go, this is kind of cool. And so I walked around the show, and there was a guy who had some sheets of paper, and he said, learn how to make beads, you know. And so I took one of those, and it took me about 2 months for me to call him. But he had a shop over in Old Town, and I went in there, and it was me and a retired pipe fitter, and I started learning how to make glass beads. And all of his former students would come in, and I noticed they all wore their beads the same way. They had this great artwork on their beads, and they would just string them on a cord.
Right.
And I thought, these people need a great way to wear and display these beads. So I thought, that's what I can do. So I started to make a line of findings in silver that would, and I like to make them interchangeable,
right,
so they can change them, because usually their favorite bead is their last bead. So they always want to change them. So I made a line of interchangeable findings in silver. And one of them was a ring. And I got a patent on, actually I have three patents, but the ring one is the most most profitable one. And so I ended up making and selling those rings at glass bead shows. And, yep, and eventually I was looking around at all the glass artists, and I thought, you know, I'm casting silver. I'm going to figure out how to cast glass.
Right.
So I figured out a special process to cast the glass, and it took me about 150 experiments. And and my wife would tell me, said, stop, because she could see I was depressed after time. But I thought, no, when I get this, it's going to be really great. And so it was. And it became reliable. The process became reliable around 2012. And so anyway, I submitted it to a lot of design competitions, and I won a lot of them. And I was actually asked to go to the Smithsonian in 2019.
Yeah. And you also have work in the Corning Museum.
Yes, I have a piece in their permanent collection, also in the Albuquerque Museum in their permanent collection, a few of them.
That's cool. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah,
so
thanks.
That thing on the glasswork actually ties in with a question we had from Gregory Coleman last week.
Okay.
On YouTube. And Gregory's question was, what's your favorite way to add color to a piece? And I'm going to assume it's glass.
Well, the easiest way is to put a stone in there, or
right. But what's your favorite way? He wants to know
my favorite way. You know, since I started working here, I really like e-coating.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
I know you've used it too. I really like it because it's very permanent. It's really durable.
Yeah.
When we were learning how to do e-coating, they gave us these discs with different colors on them. And I thought, I'm going to test this stuff. So I put it in my pocket with my keys and my change, and I walked around with it for at least 4 months. And here at Rio, we have to go through security. We take everything out and put it in these bins. And when I was putting it in the bin one day, it fell and it rolled under the security table, and I never got it back. But it had held up really well. Yeah. For like 4 months of every day, just rubbing against your keys and your change. And it was starting to get a little bit around the edges, but that's a pretty durable test.
And,
honestly.
And it's easy to
do. It's very easy to do. You just need plating equipment.
Yeah.
You do need a different rectifier that goes a little bit higher. But...
Well, yes and no. It depends on the color. But because I did over 500 of them, remember all the pins for
yes.
the SNAG conference in
yes.
2019?
Yes.
And It's actually very fast.
Was that the Portland one?
I don't remember where it was.
I think it might have been Portland. I remember seeing the rose. With those roses, right?
Yeah. It was.
City of
was,
Roses.
Yeah, City of Roses.
I remember those. We did a lot of them in that gold color. Yeah,
I dreamt about those for a while.
Anyway, they're really durable. It makes metals that you ordinarily can't wear next to your skin
right.
very well. Like yeah. copper, because you'll sweat yeah. and it reacts with the skin. Well, it makes your
There's no pre-plating required or
nope,
anything.
Nope. Super easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
it's a nano ceramic.
Yes.
Which makes it hypoallergenic.
Right.
I don't know if we can say that, but it's...
It's also a little flexible, because we had these cuffs that we made mm-hmm. with Bonnie Doon
yep.
out of like, I don't know, 18 gauge or something, yep. and they were copper and they were a little flexible. And I was, I thought, oh, this will be great. I'm going to E-coat it and I'm going to squeeze it and see if it cracks. And it actually didn't.
Yeah.
So it will withstand the flexing that people do.
Yeah. So E-coating, everybody.
Or yeah, that's a great
Gregory. E-coating, Gregory Coleman, is Greg's favorite way to color yeah. jewelry. But let me circle back around. So you did all of this phenomenal work and everything prior to getting to Rio Grande.
Okay.
So what brought you to Rio Grande? What was the transition that got you from working for this other manufacturer to coming here to Rio Grande?
The business sold.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually wasn't working for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw an ad to come be on the tech team. And I thought, I'll do that. That's different.
Yeah.
Always want to do something different.
Right.
Always got to challenge yourself and do something different.
So once you got here, you'd been a customer of Rio Grande though.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Since the 70s.
Right. So, but once you got here, because this is the thing, and I encourage everybody, get your questions in for Greg specifically. Greg is an expert on mold making, wax carving, casting, things like that. As you can tell, manufacturing, production, if you have anything.
Design.
He's helped me enormously. I'm a fabricator. Most of my stuff is one of a kind.
Yep.
All fabricated and everything. But you helped me to understand how to streamline my process and to create molds for those things that I do repetitively.
Right.
So that I'm not spending all those hours completely rebuilding it.
Right.
And you also helped me to understand how, even though I'm using something from a mold, it's still of a one of a kind.
Can be, because, yes.
Well, in my case, because the stones are always different, the engraving is always different.
Right.
And that kind of thing.
Right.
So if you have questions of any kind, you're more than welcome. We really are looking forward to answering your questions. I have one question from Polo Sandoval. He says, good afternoon, gentlemen. When setting pave stones in a ring setting, what graver should you use to split the shared prong between the stone before using a beading tool? Do you want that one, Greg? Do you do a lot of pave?
I don't.
I do a little bit.
Probably, and I would guess a flat graver.
No, I wouldn't recommend a flat graver.
For splitting?
For splitting. So for me, at least, I don't even use a graver. I've made my own little wedge out of an old burnisher, and I just push it straight into it and spreads them evenly. But if you were going to use a graver, I would use an onglet.
Okay.
If I was going to use a graver. But as we've said before on previous Tech Tuesdays, a lot of times you make your own tools. You make what you need. So like I said, if you have questions, keep them coming. We're more than happy to get them answered for you. But I want to go back, because the tech team is all about sharing knowledge.
Yeah.
All about helping people to improve their processes, to understand things better, to learn about new technologies and things like that.
Right.
And with everything you've done in manufacturing, you have 50 years of experience in the jewelry business. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't believe that looking at you, but you got 50. In June, it's 50 years, right? I heard you and Phil talking the other day.
Yeah. I started
50 years.
Yeah, I started young.
Yeah.
I was still in high school.
But 50 years of working in this industry,
right,
gives you a lot of background. What I'd like you to expand on though is mold making.
Okay.
Because that's where you had the greatest impact on me. Really helped me to understand how mold making would help my fabrication process streamline and become more efficient. So tell us a little bit about mold making.
I would like to see people think differently about molds. And I think they should. Even if you don't use molds, mm-hmm. if you're a fabricator and you make everything with bezel and wire and sheet, like you were saying, there's still, I think it will change the way you think about your jewelry, and it gives you a lot more design opportunities. I'll give you an example. So if you had a little rose or a cat or a skull or something, I think you should mold it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can take that and you can use it as a design element. If you make a mold of it and then cast a whole bunch of them, you can put them, here, let me give you an example. Like here's a sheet. Here's your bezel with your stone, right?
You got to face it that direction.
Here's your bezel with your stone. That's a really terrible drawing. But let's say you you have a mold with a little skull or a rose or something. Now you can take that, make multiple copies, and put them all around your piece.
Mm-hmm.
You can only do that if you make a mold, or you got to make 20 or 30 of them, which nobody wants to do. Also, making molds is great. Have you ever made a shank and you looked at that shank and you said, this shank is so perfect. I almost can't believe I made it. I can't see a single thing wrong with this shank. I would say mold that shank.
Right.
Because you mold it, you inject it, and you cast a whole bunch of them. Now all of your shanks are that perfect. I know. I can see you going, nah, not exactly, because they're not, you know. But let's say you add, you know, you make a V-shank and you put your flower in there. Yeah, try to fabricate that.
Yeah. It's
You can make things that are hard to fabricate. And I mean, we've all seen rings with big lion heads and stuff. I mean, I know a few people that can actually carve that stuff in metal and do a pretty good job. But what if you get an order for 50 of them?
You got to make a mold. I have a couple of friends who do that. They engrave and they sculpt the metal and everything. And their stuff isn't cheap, quote unquote. But in my opinion, for the time and energy that they're putting out to create these things, it should be 10 times what they're charging for it. And I've told them the same thing.
There's a love and a passion there too.
Right. But it would be so cool because they only make one. And then once it's out there, it's gone.
That's right.
And I've told
all
them,
you would have is a picture.
Well, this is where you sold me on the mold making. There's a lot of things I've made molds of, especially with the silicone molds because they're fast and easy. Mm-hmm. Not because I want to reproduce them, but because I know after I sell that piece, I'm never going to get it back. But now that I have this mold, I can always inject it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can at least make a copy of it that I can use as a reference.
It's a base object.
Right.
It's a base object that you can now elaborate on, and it'll get you from zero to 40% of the way much faster than starting from scratch and sawing out this cross.
As an engraver, a lot of engravers, they do castings. They do castings of their engravings because it's one thing to look at something two-dimensionally and see a drawing of somebody's engraving pattern or something. It gives you a lot of information. But the casting, you can see the actual depth of the cut. You can see the width of the cut. And you can see it in three dimensions, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where the mold making for me has come through, because I did something 2 years ago. I make a mold of it. I can at least inject it with wax. And now I've got that three-dimensional object, and it's reminding me of the depth that I used or the thicknesses of something. Because even in a photograph, then you're just guessing. You don't really know.
Right. Having best-selling items is kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a blessing because you're getting the sale, but it's a curse because you have to keep repeating your work.
Right.
So that's all I'm saying about molding. Yeah. If you, like with your shanks, you know, I'm saying mold it. And actually, it might even make sense to make molds of your sizes, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then you've got those already made.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
I've got questions coming in, Greg. So let's go to Facebook first.
Okay.
Dwayne Hall, he says, can you name the name of the treatment again for making copper safer for skin wear? And he wants to know, will it prevent patina from reacting with skin? It was E-coating that we were talking about.
Yes, E-coating. And it's made by Legora. We sell it.
Right.
so detecting a patina. Yes, it will.
Well, how do I say this? Because you have to clean the metal before you E-coat it, even if you're using a clear E-coating, a lot of times it'll remove a patina.
I have done it.
Right.
I have done it. I don't leave it in the cleaning solution as long.
Okay.
Because I want to preserve some of that oxidation patina.
So it'll
but
take
it's possible,
some,
yes.
Some practice run.
Yes, you're going to have to play with it a little bit. But imagine what happens is it goes into the solution. These little tiny beads that have a charge are attracted to the surface, which has the anode. They're attracted because of the charge. So imagine little tiny nano ceramic, because it's nano ceramic, these super tiny little beads and they completely cover the conductive surface. Then you take it out and you got to let it dry. You put it into an oven. All those little tiny plastic beads, they melt and fuse together and create this shell that's ceramic. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic.
And not only does the e-coating come in colors, we have it in clear as well.
Clear, black.
And matte and everything. So there's a whole variety of
it's
things
phenomenal.
That you can do with it.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. I love it.
But let's go to the next question. I've got a question on Instagram from Honey Blue Designs. And their question is it best to do a mold first if I plan on making multiple pieces to sell of the same design? I'm new to this process and trying to minimize my trial and error.
Yes. Mold it first. Mold it first before it gets... You don't want to take an old worn out piece. You just think of your mold. It's going to preserve whatever you mold. So if you mold a nice, sharp, crisp piece with nice detail and everything is exactly the way you like it, that's the way all your copies are going to be. I would mold it early.
And it's also important that whatever you mold, that's going to be the way it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever level of finish that you want. So what I remind people of is if it has scratches, it's going to mold those scratches.
Always finish everything as far as you can. Don't assume like I can take care of this in a tumbling step later. You're always better to get it as close to perfect as you can from the beginning.
Before you make the mold. Yeah. Right. Okay, I've got another question from Instagram. Astea Jewelry Work, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. They want to know, could e-coating be used on the back only of a metal clay piece? I'm thinking of white copper clay pieces that contain nickel.
Oh, because they're concerned about the skin.
They want to know about just using it on one side.
Sure. You can. We used to have a mask. I don't know if we still have a mask. Because the mask would have to be able to withstand about 300 degrees. You can always remove it later. I'm actually doing some experiments where I'm e-coating something and then removing it before I put it into the oven.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think it's easier there because it's not all fused together as a shell to try to like wipe it off with a soft brush or something. And I got to apologize. I haven't really done that all the way yet, but that's possibly a way to do it.
Right. But we have the masking pins is what you're referring to. And then you can remove it with an acetone. I remove it with acetone.
Okay.
But there's some people use fingernail polish. There's all different masking methods.
As long as it will withstand that curing process, I forget what it is. It's different for different colors.
But what I'm saying is when you mask it, like with fingernail polish, for example, you're going to remove that before you cure it because otherwise it's going to burn off.
Well, you can't just dip it
because
all the little beads aren't fused together yet.
It's time consuming.
Yeah.
You can dip it, then you got to remove the e-coating, and then you got to...
We were also experimenting with some kind of like rubber cement kind of stuff where you kind of peel it away. And actually, that might be a great way to do it.
So to be more specific,
Astea
Jewelry.
Yes, you can.
It's doable. But it's going to take experimentation. We don't have a tried and true method yet that we can say this is exactly how to do it.
But you can also coat them in clear.
Yeah, exactly.
You can coat them in clear and the whole thing is protected.
Right.
And you can't really see it. So if you want to protect the whole thing, I mean, what if you're wearing it and it flips?
Mm-hmm.
You want to protect both sides probably.
We need to circle back.
Okay.
We have the Art of the Artifice had a follow-up question about the pave setting. They wanted to know about the chisel that I was talking about. They say they favor an 80 to 90 degree, but they're no expert. I can't tell you exactly the degrees on the chisel that I'm using. It's less than...
Something you made.
Yeah, it's probably like 70 degrees. I ground it down and I put it in there and it's enough to split the prong so that it goes over both sides simultaneously. So
and after that you
and then I put a
bead on it
so I couldn't tell you the angles, sorry, but whatever works. I mean, a lot of times you end up making multiple tools. Some of them are very, very specific.
Those are the best tools, the ones you make. Yeah.
We've got another question on Instagram from Lunic Jewelry. Mm-hmm. And it says, according to plating, do you recommend coating them at the end for extra protection? And how could you make the gold plating more durable?
Just like I said, you can coat it with a clear.
Right, the e-coat.
Yes, you can e-coat it with a clear, and that would definitely protect the gold. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't affect how the gold shines. You could still see it as gold.
Right, and as far as gold plating, there's really no way to make it more durable. It is what it is.
You know, I think acid-based solutions are slightly more durable than cyanide-based, mm-hmm. and also you don't have the cyanide.
Right.
So acid-based gold solutions are slightly more durable. But yes, an e-coating.
A clear e-coating is ideal.
Oh, it's going to save it a lot longer.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I've got a question from YouTube. Christine Norse Dragon Weber wants to know, if you reticulate silver, use it in a project that includes some solder, and then decide to scrap it, can it be melted down, rolled flat, and re-reticulated, or does the solder prevent it from working?
Don't know.
It definitely is going to change the composition of the material.
Yeah.
And how it reacts.
Because you're bringing stuff to the surface that wasn't there before.
Right.
So once you bring it up to the surface, and then you're adding other stuff like solder,
right,
and then you try to roll it back down, I think it's going to affect the way that it crinkles.
It's going to be trial, because no two things are going to be the same. But it's definitely not going to be sterling anymore, because you've changed the overall composition of it.
Right.
And I think that's something people need to keep in mind. When you're melting down your own scraps and everything, there's clean scrap and there's dirty scrap.
Yeah.
And there's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Especially when you're going to do the resale.
Right.
Because you're not going to get the same amount of money for dirty scrap that you get for clean scrap, because the refiners have to do more work to break it down.
Right.
So when you are keeping your scrap, I encourage people to keep separate from anything that has solder in it.
Exactly.
And assume that all of your filings and everything are dirty.
Right.
And
their question also brings up an interesting point too. We're asked a lot of questions that are kind of, you know, that are not common. You know, that's why we get asked the questions. So, and a lot of times we don't know the answer because we haven't done it. But the thing that I always say to people is do a test.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So do a test. Maybe not on your important work, but do a test.
I always tell people to keep a notebook.
Yeah.
Use the scientific method.
Yeah.
And keep notes. Because as much as we think, oh, I'm going to remember this, and I'm only speaking for myself, 9 times out of 10, I forget it.
Yeah.
But I've got these little notebooks that I've got notes in, and some of them are 20 years old.
I do the same thing, yeah.
And, you know, the pencil is rubbed and everything, but...
You can't remember what setting you had or what the temperature was or what, you know, 10 years ago, you can't remember that.
I have people who see a piece of jewelry that I made 20 years ago, and they're like, can I order one of those? And you hate to say no, but it's like, I can't even remember how I made that.
Pull the mold off the shelf.
Well, if I had a mold, it would be the way to go.
You got
a
mold thing.
We've got another follow-up question from Christine Norse Dragon Weber. Uh-huh. She wants to know another question I've got. She says she's got a few of them today.
Okay.
Can rose gold be granulated, or does the copper in it make it impossible?
Wow. I would think it. Here again, another experiment. Do a small experiment, because I haven't done it. Have you?
I actually have. If she's referring to granulation as in melting it, making balls.
Making perfect spheres.
Yes, I've done that.
That you can...
Have I done it consistently? No. So it's a simple, yes, you can, but you're going to have to practice. And I think it also depends on the caratage. It balls up much better when it's higher carat.
Higher.
Which means there's less copper in it. So it's not going to be as rosy as something with more copper in it.
Right, right.
But it definitely, you can definitely ball the metal up.
Oh, sure.
But the consistency, now you can't fuse it the way you can do 22 and 24 karat granules.
Pure, close to pure.
Yeah. You know, the fusing is not going to happen.
No, I wouldn't think so.
And then you're going to have to mess with some of that that rose gold solder, which I hate.
Yeah.
Always is.
I know. So
is a pain.
And you know what? I know that some granulation people have been they will come in with a laser welder and tack.
Right.
They'll tack things in place so they don't move.
Yeah. The pulse arc welder is great for that.
Yeah.
Or a laser.
Laser. They're using the laser a lot.
And that's the other thing a lot of people aren't aware of. I didn't know this until I went to a class recently, and the guy that I took the class with was Master Stonesetter, and he was explaining to me how he uses the laser welder to make the beads on his pause base settings.
Yes.
And it made so much sense after he explained it. But when when he first said, "Oh yeah, I just used the laser welder to make the beads," and I was like, "Huh?"
And you know who I heard that also from is Lonnie here in town.
Yeah.
He and they were doing some assembly line type pave, and they had one guy pushing a curl, and that's all he did. He just pushed the curl, and then he handed it to the laser welder, and they went under and they hit the curl and just like bam, bam, bam. They were polished and everything.
Yeah. So it was a one shot. That's what he was explaining to me. He said you save so much time and everything.
Yes.
And there's no risk of slippage or any of that kind of thing.
No.
But yeah, it's there's so many tricks.
Yes.
And I think that's the advantage. I know it's an advantage since I've been on the tech team now for over 6 years.
Yeah.
And before I came here, I didn't have the time to. I was so busy. I was at my bench.
Just doing your thing.
Humped over my bench. Grinding it out, making jewelry, right? But once I came here, it was like this cornucopia of knowledge that it was like, holy cow, I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I encourage people, you know, everybody out there who's watching this, whether you're watching it live or you're watching a recording of it, Tech Team Tuesday is a perfect opportunity to ask questions to people who have been there, done that, or they know somebody who has.
Yes.
And you can ask those questions, which brings us to another question. We've got another question on Instagram.
Sure.
Tribulet Escola. I would like to know if they use any products to ensure the gold doesn't lose its shine when soldering.
Well, that's one of the big advantages of the barrier flux.
Yeah.
I was working with a silversmith, a friend of mine named Paul. He's deaf. He's a phenomenal silversmith. I showed him barrier flux, and at that time, I just used the what's the pink one that we sell?
I know what it looks like. I
forgot the name of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, we sell a barrier flux, and it's not flammable. It doesn't have alcohol in it, but it's pink in color. I'll remember it. But anyway, He made a piece and he polished it, and I told him dip it in here and and then solder on it, and even coming out of the pickle, you would think the pickle would make it white too, but he pulled it out of the pickle and he just rubbed it with his hand and he goes, wow, look, it's still it's going to take a lot less, like it's already pre-polished, so all you got to do is hit a final.
That barrier flux is good on sterling as well.
Yes.
And that's what I try to explain to people, because it's something that isn't commonly taught. And some people think that it's an extra step and it's unnecessary. But in the long run, it really saves you a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
It cuts down on the fire scale.
Yes.
Or the fire stain, whichever you prefer to call it, that kind of thing. And it's just one of those things where you're working smarter, not harder.
Yes.
But yeah. So, We're coming to the end of our time here, Greg. I wanted to ask you questions about wax carving, and we didn't even get to that.
Okay.
So we're going to have to do this again.
Okay.
Because you're a plethora of information.
Thanks.
And let me check here real quick. The flux you were talking about is the Stopox.
Stopox 2.
And
Roman numeral 2.
It's Stopox 2 anti-fire scale coating spray.
Yeah.
And we got that in there.
Yeah.
Like I said, we're going to have to do this again. Remember, everybody, Lindstrom 1 for 10% off all Lindstrom items for the month of April. Lindstrom 1 is the code. If you haven't ever used Lindstrom cutters or pliers, I encourage you to. They're some of the best in the world. And before we go, I want to ask you one question.
Yep.
I have these canned questions that I tend to ask people. But this is one I haven't asked a couple of people in a couple of interviews. But I want to ask you, because you've been doing this for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you went back to your 12-year-old self and you could give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be? Because you've had a very successful career. You've had a great life.
You know, I would say go deeper in the specialties that you like,
mm-hmm.
and get the best training you can possibly get.
Yeah.
Go to the person who's doing the thing that you want to do, because that's the only person who can tell you how to get there.
Right.
And they may not even be teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have talked people into teaching me how to do stuff who weren't teaching or didn't have a class or anything. Yeah. I just convinced them just to teach me one-on-one or whatever. But a lot of times people will do that. So I would say approach them and ask them. But yes, get the best training you can possibly get in the area that you love, that you have a passion for.
That's a perfect segue out of our Tech Team Tuesday today. So next Tuesday, 11 a.m. Mountain Time, don't forget Lindstrom 1. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Bye.